bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Hello.
And Bryce the Legend Castillo.
Hello, it's me, the Legend.
the Ledge Man.
Oh my God, we're so glad you're here. Tell me, do the Ledge Wars, do they continue on the fringes of society?
The Legend Wars never end, Brian.
Oh my God.
Wow, you know, man. I always know that the Legend's here when he moves his hands up and down like Frankenstein.
It's part, when there's no wind, I have to create the wind effect myself.
Can I just say, though, Bryce, your range, like, if we shipped you off to England to, like, one of those fancy English acting schools where you get to learn how to talk like Hugh Laurie and anything else like this, I think you'd come back, you know, and you could have, my Patrick Stewart voice.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Very space cross.
Space cross.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Space cross.
I want to talk about something. I think we may have mentioned this before, but did we talk about the website This Fursona Does Not Exist?
No. We've talked about, like, this person doesn't exist.
And I think we've even talked about this waifu does not exist.
I think we talked about these feet do not exist.
Yeah.
Foot fetishists.
I think we didn't, because I remember wanting to really talk about that, and I think we didn't.
But, yeah.
Okay, so.
Oh.
Wow, it's a furry version.
Right on.
So we're looking at all of these different sort of like furry sort of avatars. And what they did is it uses we've talked about these before, generative adversarial networks, which is basically you take a system that's trained to recognize certain things, in this case, like animal faces, and then you take a randomizer and you give it feedback. And basically it starts spitting out images that never existed before. We've done this with people and the other stuff we mentioned. This does this with furry avatars in a variety of different styles.
I mean, that one looks an awful lot like Robin Hood.
Oh, see, I thought...
No, that one... No, that looks like Zootopia.
Nick, yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, and that brings up the issue here, is that they trained this using a data set, I forget from what web, some website, where people had created, you know, their own personas. And they used the group who did this just used the data to train the neural network. And some of the things spitting out here look very similar to things that have been created by other people, but not identical. Mm. And it's bringing up the concept of, you know, there's a term I just heard, kind of like, you know, generative art or generative media, the idea of stuff that's generated from AI. And what, you know, what is the copyright on this? What is this? Where is this sort of, where does this, what happens from here?
That's an interesting idea, because I think what happens is the strand of evidence begins to matter, right? Where it's like so many of the stories of copyright violation have been reduced down to, well, tell us the story of how you made this song. Sounds to me like you definitely heard this other song and then ripped it off. Judgment is against you. And then other people are like, well, I had a dream and this is the way I try to write. And then, you know, and then if it's a better story, then it's like you are forgiven or whatever. But I suspect that a lot of people will be able to hide behind, like, there's literally no way I could have copied a thing because I said, please summon me a fox with five red spots.
Well, two things. One is often in copyright, though, you have to specifically copy the lyrics or, let's say, the melodies. And if it's one or two bit different, then it makes it harder to get. And that's why those decisions land all over the place.
Unless we're talking about Blurred Lines, which for some reason you copied.
But that was very notable in how far it extended beyond.
Correct. That was a bad decision.
In fact,
yes.
Yeah, and you could look at the notation, the musical notation, and see this is the same notation that was used from this other thing. You know, versus sound alike is an entire industry where it's just, no, we just changed that part and we're close enough.
But then on the flip side, there's Come Together, in which case What's the difference between riffing on a thing, like giving a tip of the hat, like, hey, I'm saying that thing that's the beginning of another song, here come old flat top. But then it's like, well, are you acknowledging it and tipping your hat to it, or are you mm-hmm. just using it in a different song?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's always, you know, whenever you hear about cases going up there, when it gets beyond just clearly like sampling 30 seconds of something, and that's been like, there's some areas where you go, oh yeah, that's easy, we know, you can pretty much predict where the judgment's going to fall here. And that was like Blurred Lines, because it was a pretty clear case of like, as I understood it, like, yeah, no, this is literally like this whole sequence and stuff. Where other things where it gets to be, you know, the Stairway to Heaven, you know, where you're like, oh, well, who said this? It's like, well, this is a lot like Taurus or whatever, this band. Like, yeah, but it's also like this band that was in there 10 years before and stuff. Here, the problem gets into is neural networks are a black box. If you could say, yeah, I went and I had this thing created and the box did it. But if you don't, what if it was trained on those original images?
Well, and if you know, don't give it enough imagery, right, then you would have to assume it would give you very, very similar. If, say, instead of giving it, what, thousands of images, you gave it tens of images, it would probably look pretty similar to those 10 copyrighted works.
Yeah, and like if I built one, let's say I only trained it on Jack Kirby drawings, and it gave me original, new illustrations, new drawings. I, as an artist, I can draw. If I could draw like Jack Kirby, I could do it. I could publish comics as long as I'm not copying his verbatim, you know, not copying his actual drawings. But if I'd say I'm going to draw it like him and do this like him, legal. Hmm. You know, and so that gets into the whole, where does this go from here?
You know what's interesting? You brought up the Dark Side of the Moon and Taurus case. I was looking that up for undisclosed reasons. And
Stairway to Heaven.
Right, yeah. Or Stairway to Heaven, excuse me. The most recent ruling was that that it was an infringement, and the court made this precedent that you actually, they said, we used to judge how likely it was you heard a song before you recorded it, and gave it in the inverse proportional rule, where it was more likely you heard it, you have a much higher bar. I think they did away with that almost completely via precedent, because content is so ubiquitous now. So you are just bombarded on, like, as humans, just human beings having copyright issues, you are just bombarded with so much stimulus that it's very difficult to, I don't know, try to say, well, you saw my thing, so obviously you did it. But then when it becomes, I guess the flip side is machine learning, where you are definitely giving it someone else's work.
Hmm. Or, yeah. I mean, well, I guess that one step farther is you allowed it to go find work, and it finds a style, and you know, you're not the one that caused it to, you know, dial in on late 60s, you know, cheap Fender guitars, garage era music, but then it comes back with, I got this great idea, you know, this pitch.
Yeah.
Well, again, I think that we also sort of have to differentiate too between something that does something in the style of, or something when it kind of directly emulates it. And these things are incredible at emulating style. And like I said before, like I can create, you know, my own cover band and write my own songs based on, you know, inspired by Kiss or whatever like this. And I can do, you know, can't do their same makeup because they can copyright that, but I can do my own songs, sound like them, do as much as I want to sort of do this. And there have been people who've tried to sort of copyright a certain kind of define a sound or look, and it's hard because it gets to be nebulous. And really, you're kind of left with, we can copyright the words, and if you can, you know, if you can put the music into a chart notation, you can copyright that. But beyond that is when it gets hard. And I think here we're getting in this area where you could build things that are, I could, you know, sample Brian's voice, and then, you know what? I'm going to do my podcast using Brian's voice.
Yeah, and although by the way, and I don't want to go back to too far into the Blurred Lines thing, but that was the Blurred Lines. Blurred Lines was not identical to Gotta Give It Up. It had a similar groove and it had similar spacing, but the chart notation was not identical, and that was where we started to get into new territory that is kind of is fairly widely criticized as being overreaching in terms of that settlement.
Which to go back even farther, okay, reminds me, it sounds to me even closer to the Dennis Leary, Bill Hicks similarities, where Bill Hicks was a transformative comedian in the late 80s, early 90s, who died of cancer. And then suddenly, with a lot of similar bits, a lot of similar attitudes, you have Dennis Leary. I don't know what the right answer is in terms of recompense to the aggrieved party, who the aggrieved party would be, and whether or not if comedy is better off for somebody else picking up the mantle or not.
Well, I mean, in that case, it's like, look, I think that's more of a comics code thing of like, all right, like gentleman's how rules. Much are you a good or bad person for taking things or how much are you doing an impression versus your own stuff? In terms of the market, people were hungry for Hicks and Hicks wasn't there. So the next best thing stepped up and capitalized on it and became a bigger star than Hicks was, you know, may not be as talented or as revered amongst his peers, but certainly, you know, was, you know, he took that market demand and fed it.
So Andrew, if there was, say, one of these GAN models that was based only on your writing, how would you feel about the publication of a work generated using only your content as the source?
And a whole genre of Andrew Main type books.
Yeah, it would be frustrating because, you know, you would find yourself competing with yourself. And the hard part too would be that if somebody wanted to say, you know, if somebody wanted to, you know, the way the rule of thumb might be, if somebody decided to, you know, read everything I wrote and then write like me, which is actually something writers will often start doing, is that there are, you know, Kevin J. Anderson, you know, who's a very prolific writer. One of the things that Kevin J. Anderson is exceptionally good at is at doing the voices of other writers. And there are some writers who actually he could, you know, when he can pick up like a series, he could write like he could do Edgar Rice Burroughs or whatever. He's very capable of doing that sort of thing and picking this up. And that's a skill some writers have. And that's why some writers make a living as ghostwriters, too, is because they can read somebody else's books and go in and write in that voice. And there are, you know, when Stephen King was super popular, you start looking at a lot of stuff that came around that time and you realized a lot of writers tried to adapt and sort of do that. And you see that anytime something's very popular, people try to emulate it. An AI trained on me to do this would be the most efficient mimic ever. I would personally, I assume that's going to happen. I assume, and not necessarily that it's going to be, you know, me per se, but I think that you train something on me or better writers or whatever, and you're going to get stuff that's going to come out that will be really well done, you know, better than maybe I could do. And I've been in positions before where like having created magic and then one, there's sometimes people would copy the move for move my explanation and put it on YouTube, which I considered that, you know, a violation where they just literally redid my video, which is, you know, that and the choreographic works are protected under copyright and that's established. It was another thing where somebody says, well, I'm going to explain how this thing works, which aggravated me, but they can do that. And I never had a problem with that. You know, I was never going to try to stop that because I think from a legal point of view, no, they're right to do that. And I would say that I would be personally frustrated if all of a sudden I saw like, oh, you know, Bryce Castillo, you know, AI writing in the style of Andrew Main. Yeah, hey, it's the world. I mean, we've established law. Like you look at all the porn parodies that use licensed characters, you know, yeah. Like it's pretty much just, if you say parody, you say this, whatever. And I'm going to say that like, yeah, I'm going to be on the other side of this, not benefiting me, but I don't really want to be in a world where we say, no, you can't do this. Because also, let's say you just tell people that you it's a style that you do and you don't tell us you use AI. How would I know?
Mm. Yeah, definitely not a thriller written by Andrew Main.
From Parody Publishing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things where like it would not benefit me. It would, but I would have to say yes, but I'm okay with it. You know, like there's a lot of times and stuff I watch the advance of technology. I go, oh yeah, this is going to make my life more difficult, but ethically or legally, legal to do this, you know? So,
yeah.
Similar question, say for you, Brian, right? Like someone takes the, you know, all the recorded footage of you and makes a voice, you know, a voice synthesis, you know, text to speech thing of your voice and starts putting up, say, podcasts with your voice. What? How would you feel in that? It's hypothetical, right? But
yeah, I would be less threatened by that, partly because I suspect the market for people who want a robot version of my voice in their head is smaller than one would expect. However, we were talking today where it's like, if you were in a foreign market, you could take the 800 plus episodes of Scam School Scam Nation and just redo them. And I'm not sure that I would have much recourse. I suppose I could point out the similarities in the types of shots and all that stuff, in which case, you know, just change the shots of them or whatever. Because
you're talking about a whole production redoing.
Yeah.
Not taking the original.
So you would say, you know, this is in Russia or China or something like that, that they could literally just take everything that you did and redo it as in their best facsimile.
Right.
And which what are you going to do?
Which we have in authentic ways, for example. I mean, you know, The Office was a UK original that came to the United States and we redid it pretty much following it. We found our own way or whatever. Same thing. Breaking Bad has since gone to Latin America and it's pretty much just Breaking Bad re-recorded from scratch. Those are cases where I assume some amount of money was exchanged.
Their official adaptations.
Yeah. So I don't know what it would look like an unofficial or without permission. There's kind of some handshake agreements. We have some fans in Russia who love Modern Rogue, and we have a handshake agreement of what all they want to do is just record voiceovers to translate our stuff to Russian. And they do it because they love it. And as far as I know, they're not rolling in bank and there's no pie for us to argue about splitting up. But, you know, what a great situation that'd be if we ended up there.
Same question to you, Justin, right? Someone takes your voice and makes a political podcast. How do you feel about that?
I'd see how good the tech is because, you know, it's a lot cheaper than a guest host. So, you know, like sometimes I might need to go on vacation. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I would suspect, as Brian, that there is less of an issue because, you know, it's not like there's a tremendous barrier to entry for our content now. It's free content now. But also, if one of the market demands is, oh, okay, well, one podcast is good, but it would be better if you were doing five little podcasts, so I was always up to date on what the opinion was, then that could offer that. I don't know. I mean, it would be annoying if it were eroding the core business, but otherwise, I have no idea what market demand it would want to fill.
All right, cool.
Like, Andrew's is a little bit more of a clear-cut case because, like, it could erode a brand that ends in a financial transaction, whereas, you know, for Brian, it would really have to degrade his ability to sell advertising on Scam Stuff or Modern Rogue. Or for me, it would have to erode the faith in my Patreon that people would not want to be less likely to support me directly.
Hmm. I think that, you know, the hopeful part is that, you know, the technology, from the technology point of view is that it would make it easier for, you know, like, you know, Brian, for, you know, you and Jason to make a different version of, because like there's technology right now that will translate your voice into another language and then will match the lips, will adjust the lips as you speak to that language. So you could release the Russian version of this eventually at some point where you guys are going to be speaking Russian and you're sounding like you're fluent and also trained on your voice. So it will be you with a Russian, with your voice with a Russian accent, and the lips will move in sequence. And that's kind of a fascinating sort of thing, is, you know, where that goes.
I do think that is totally fascinating. I also feel like the moment that starts to get used, it totally ceases to be novel and people discount it. Like, oh, this is one of those dub subs or whatever.
Even if it means that they get, say, native audio in lieu of like just subtitles on YouTube?
Yeah. Like, I think, for example, what was it? All You Need Is Kill became Edge of Tomorrow. I know here in America, more people paid attention to Edge of Tomorrow, the thing that was a complete retelling of that story, just with American actors doing American stuff. and not just a redub of that popular anime.
Interesting.
But we watch all the time around the world. People watch things, cartoons and other things, dubbed with local people. You know, like you know, more people have watched Toy Story in a language other than English than people have watched it in English.
That's true. And maybe I'm suffering from the bias of knowing that we are one of the larger exporters of that type of content than importers. So it's hard. And maybe I have a blind spot for the potential of importing.
Mm-hmm. I know that I watched, was it Ragnarok? That was okay. But, you know, it was not Netflix. It's this Norwegian show about, you know, this young kid who's modern day time, sort of a retelling of, you know, Norse mythology. And they did the dubbing and it was good enough dubbing. And I preferred that dubbing to reading subtitles, you know, and I would like it to be even better
too. Like I found, like I watched Omniscient a couple months back, which is a Brazilian sci-fi show. And I much preferred hearing it in English, even though it probably was, you know, when you have to translate something for visuals, you have to adjust the script in certain ways. But I preferred that over the subtitles for something like that. I don't know.
Well, the technology's gotten better. You know, they're not using the AI lip thing yet, but they're using much better sort of technology to make it match and fit and stuff. So that helps. And so I think that, I don't know, I'm excited about the potential where, you know, you could make versions that could be different versions of stuff, but also comes with though the market for, you know, the Brian Brushwood version of something like this is, you don't know. You don't know what it is. And it could be more than we realize, or it could be a small group of just 1,000 people, but love to watch, you know, want to watch Home Improvement where it's Brian.
Yeah. Well, and I do believe there is potential for there. I suppose, but the only caveat I want to inject is once it's a known thing, much like the laugh track, we were previously talking about how once you know there's such a thing as a laugh track, that alters your understanding of this piece of content that you're watching. Once you know that, you know, Brian did not bother to put on makeup and play 35 different characters, all to create a one Brian person of a show, It that somehow affects the novelty of watching Brian play everyone.
But if it's useful.
But I think that at that point, Brian becomes an animator. We think of Brian in the same way that we do, you know, a Seth MacFarlane, you know, or, you know, Dan Roiland or Dan Harmon and, you know, Justin Roiland. We think of you in that regard where, oh, yeah, some of its voice is based on him. He's the master. He's the Disney of this.
Yeah.
Of, you know, coming this. You know, Walt used to do Mickey Mouse. His other animators did Mickey Mouse better, so then Mickey Mouse, you know, was taken over by other people. Walt was the original Mickey Mouse voice. And then, you know, when other people did Mickey Mouse, it didn't really matter. Same with Sesame Street. We've had a lot, I would say that, you know, like the guy, the new Kermit, I doesn't really sound like Kermit to me. That's been my biggest issue. I just have to bring that up. I have to say that Kermit doesn't sound like Kermit anymore.
I was waiting for the compliment, and then I saw your face. I'm like, he's not going to give a compliment.
No, he couldn't. Yeah. You turned
it's the
on
one
that
voice.
One.
It's the one time a voice has been taken over by somebody that I go, oh, I don't know. Like, but, and like, we hear, like, not every time you hear, like, Lisa Simpson on The Simpsons, is it Yardley Smith, or sometimes Smith. And like some of these big, like these big budget movies, these animated movies and stuff, Toy Story, stuff like this, very often, like, you will get other characters, like, will be played. They'll go like, oh, we need a line, but we don't want to bring Tom Hanks in. And actually, like in his case, he's got like a brother that will do his voice for him in cases like this.
Wow.
I know I met a comedian that's a white guy that does Eddie Murphy's voice for the Shrek movies when, you know, he doesn't want to do a line or whatever. Donkey. Sometimes it's Eddie Murphy. Sometimes it's not.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That happens way, way, way more often than people realize. That was like remember The Simpsons.
I don't think I'm talking too far out of school. I knew one of the donkey performers at Universal. And there's sort of like there's a hierarchy.
The Shrek donkey, not the
Yeah. But sort of the dominant, most donkiest donkey performer, not black. But yeah. Bunch of black people who aspired to reach the level of white official donkey.
You know, talking about like the loss of novelty, if it's something where like in these cases where it's useful and invisible or mostly invisible in terms of like localization stuff, like I don't know. I think it stops being like a you know, press release big to do and it turns into like it just happens invisibly around you.
Yeah, I like it when John Williams is conducting, but I don't really know that I know when John Williams is conducting. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Man.
Cool.
Copyright stuff. That's complicated. You know what's not complicated? Going to patreon.com/weirdthings, supporting this show.
Oh, crap. We never did the plug.
We're doing it right now, man.
I mean, it's after things, though, so they already are on it, but you can go to patreon.com/weirdthings and support us. Oops.
Good up.
Picks?
I started watching. I have half a pick. I only watched the first half of it. I think we talked about it on one of the programs, Troop Zero, an Amazon original. It's kind of cute and adorable, and I don't know what got me to start watching it, but I enjoyed the first half very much, and I look forward to watching the last half.
Oh, this is the Allison Janney one.
The
Girl Scout summer camp kind of thing.
Yeah, it takes place in 1977. There's a kid who wants to reach out to the stars, finds out that there's going to be a golden record, and they'd like one of the voices to be a birdie scout, a completely unrelated scout troop. So she has to form a birdie scout. Oh, guess what? It's a conniving, backstabbing world. The birdie scout world. So they assign her Troop Zero. And so a ragtag group of people have to get their badges so that they could officially apply to possibly get their voice on the golden record. Well, I wonder how it'll end.
Is it a movie or a series?
Yeah, it's a single movie, came out, on Amazon Prime.
Cool. Very cool.
Troop Zero. Justin, you got a pick?
I'm still watching Community. Community's good. Started the third season. It's interesting to see them kind of stretch that universe. And I'm fascinated by the Pierce character, like the fact that it is so close to what kind of publicly is known about Chevy Chase's actual demeanor to like the people around him. Like it's a meta achievement in a show that is meta in and of itself. I can't get over it. It's just straight up
Chevy Chase being Chevy Chase. We bothered to change the name that we call him.
Well, yeah, and even down to the idea that, like, whenever people need to fall in love with him again, he does a Chevy Chase pratfall. Like, that's, like, the one thing that no matter what a piece of garbage Chevy Chase can be and how many awful stories you either have had experienced personally or heard about him, nobody can resist Chevy Chase falling down on something, and you're just like, there he goes. Like, if only he never talked, he would be the most beloved icon in entertainment. But yeah, it's that and the Abed characters, but are fascinating. I'm curious to see where that goes. Where I guess the third season was that the last one that had Harmon before he got fired? Yeah. Did he get fired after the third season?
Yeah, fourth season was non-Harmon.
Was the non-Harmon season. So I'm excited to get to the end of this, and then we'll get into the dicey after times.
Yeah. I am just about done with my binge of HBO's The Sopranos. I started this, a month or so ago. Very interesting in how, the first season feels very like prestige TV, right? You know, we're really trying to say something about modern masculinity and the emerging tech emerging in terms of organized crime. And here in this, I just finished the fifth season, and it's a lot of fighting over the families. It really kind of proceduraled out. But starting the sixth season, starts off with a bang, and I'll be interested to see how it unfolds in this final. I guess it was like a two half seasons thing.
I'm very curious to see how you process those seasons. Yeah. Because I got some feelings.
It's funny that you were less interested the further they got away from Dr. Melfi.
Yeah, I kind of thought his therapist getting a further and further back seat. Every time that, you know, he stopped going to her or whatever, it always felt like, okay, we're going to spend a few episodes of him kind of being off the leash. And then whenever he came back, especially the first time he comes back, it's very awkward between the two of them. I think once he starts having different feelings about her, I think that's interesting. But otherwise, it was just like a lot of like, here's some Goodfellas stuff. Here's what Goodfellas stuff looks like when you have cell phones.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing is that so much of the fan base were like, no, I'm here for Goodfellas the series. So can we please get the stupid therapist off the screen? Because every time that she's talking to her, he's not doing some gangster stuff, and I'm here for the gangster stuff. So Melfi was a very divisive character, and it was welcomed by a core element of that audience when it was first airing that they made it less of a thing. But it's so funny. You might be the first person that I've ever heard being like, this sucks. Bring back Melfi.
It doesn't suck, but it's definitely, you can definitely tell when they introduce her after that first season or so.
No, it becomes more about like the territory and whether am I stepping on this? Should we request a parlay? Like, it becomes a lot more of that element and less the like, am I a man if I admit that I have feelings?
Yeah.
Let's also shoot someone. The Sopranos.
Bum, bum.
Having seen a little bit of what goes on behind the scenes of how stuff gets pitched and what gets greenlit and, you know, oh, well, the execs here, they want a show that does blank, blank, blank. I could very much see it was like with David Chase that it's like HBO is like, he's like, I want to do a mob story, modern day. What's the New Jersey mob like now? What's it like now? Let's do a modern sort of. And they're like, yeah, we need another angle on that. You're like, Analyze That was a cool movie. You know, mobster talking to a psychologist. Like, we like that idea. You know, what's inside his head? Let's have a psychologist character. It's like, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can do that. This is what people want.
Which is funny because
that's one of
the plot lines at the end of season six is, oh, between the ring and the other Blair Witch, they're like, we should get into horror movies. They're cheap. So we're going to pitch a horror movie meets a gangster film.
That's some of the best stuff.
They all gang up against Casper.
No, what's the name? What's the name of the screenplay?
Not Cleaver is the name he wants. He wants to call it Cleaver. I don't remember the other,
but that's
pitch meeting with a bunch of other gangsters, and they're like, yeah, so, you know, the Butcher of New Jersey. And someone goes, you can't call him the Butcher. There's already a the Butcher. You don't want to upset him.
Well, that's a real thing though. And like, I can tell you by looking at like the HBO lineup, like I have a very good idea what the network, like they talk about network needs and what they were telling, they're going out to script writer, you know, showrunners and stuff saying what we're looking for, because you start seeing like, this is the element here. This is this element here. And this is what they just renewed here because that nobody wanted to watch that thing. And they keep bringing this back because somebody's really got an excitable aspect of it. They want a thing and they keep trying to put a thing there and showrunners keep trying to make a thing work. And it's just, I could say more, but I don't want to have the cabal kill me. But you certainly see that. And, you just sort of like, I always say like, get past the first couple episodes because that's when the showrunners are getting noted to death from the executives. That's when they're trying to make it. So, and I often like I'm trying to watch Avenue Q or Avenue 5 or whatever. Avenue 5,
the HBO Hugh Laurie space thing.
And it's hard to get past this first because it's just everything's just hitting off. They're doing these camera movements and stuff when people are talking, trying to add intensity, and it's distracting, and the jokes aren't landing. And I'm like, get into the next couple episodes, see if this gets better, because right now this is the pilot. It's a big budget pilot, which means there's a bunch of executives on the set saying, do this, do this, do this.
Yeah.
Because what an amazing cast.
I haven't heard much about it, which has made me not watch it, despite the fact that I love like everything Inucci does is like so up my alley. But I'll get to it.
Yeah.
Do you have a pick, Andrew?
My pick is going to be the book I've been reading, and I'll probably mention this again on Weird Things, but this is a pre-pick. I went back to go reread this, and as I started reading it, I realized, oh yeah, they're making this into a TV series right now, and that is Ringworld.
Oh, cool.
You ever read Ringworld? Oh, nice.
I did. It felt of its time, what, 60s-ish?
70s-ish, I think.
70s, yeah.
So Ringworld is the premise of this explorers. Like I would say that it's actually to me like the female characters absolutely are sort of a bit kind of like the 60s sort of female characters where they're complimented, yet they're kind of there to be pretty and to have sex with the protagonist kind of part. But the idea that Ringworld is about a group of, you know, two humans and two aliens go to explore this Ringworld, which is unlike a Dyson sphere. It's this a ring around an entire star, which is about the surface area of a million Earths, and trying to find out who built it, what goes on there, whatever. And so it's kind of an adventure sort of story in that. And it became a series of many novels of throughout there that they continued on. And I've actually enjoyed it. I remember rereading it a while ago. I said, let me go back into it and read it again. And it's really kind of one of those sort of the category of stories. It's sort of more about like, let's explore a thing. Let's go take a journey to see what this would be like. And the scientific details are pretty good. I enjoyed that. And I, you know, it reminded me like there's another pick that I didn't get as much attention, but man, a story that I really liked was Eon by Greg Bear. Did you guys ever read that?
I did not.
Yeah. No, I think I might still have your copy.
Yeah, that was another where there's this mysterious, you know, cylindrical shaped meteor or asteroid sort of shows up in like, you know, Earth orbit and called the Stone. And we go to investigate what's inside of it. And I have to say that a lot of times, like to go find out what's inside of something is usually nowhere near as interesting as like the anticipation, like sphere. And I'm a big Michael Crichton fan, but to say that it's like it's never as exciting. It was even more interesting, you know, once you find out what was going on inside of it and what this meant.
Interesting.
I won't spoil it. And Eon was cool because Eon was written in 1985. And they had a thing where they talk about kind of like the future sort of technology where people talk and they have like what they described is what we would call emojis pop up from like a necklace or something around you, explaining to show you your emotions and stuff. And I thought that was such, you know, so cool to read something from the 1980s, the idea of enhancing our language with using these symbols.
Yeah, that's super cool.
So
Eon.
That's my pick. If you're not entering Ringle, check out Eon by Greg Bear. It is like one of my favorite picks for sci-fi stuff.
Cool.
Nice.
Cool. It's Ben After.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.